The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to our Monday Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston, and thank you for tuning in. We have an exciting program today, and we are on the 60-minute format, and because our guests have about 60 minutes to spend with us. So if you do want to communicate with our guests by email or through our blog or our toll-free line, remember the time frame, 60 minutes. And that's it. So we're going to shorten down all of the announcements in order to have as much time as possible with our guests. Our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Email drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then you can also send us a blog message. Again, go to thespaceshow.com. On the far right side, you'll see the upcoming show menu. This is program number 1 on upcoming shows. And that is also our archive page for this program. So open it up, and comments are, as you might expect, down at the bottom. And if you post a comment, we will get it immediately, and I can bring it up with our guest. So please do that. Just a couple of other real quick upfront announcements, and that is you are free to download our shows and share them, but please don't do anything commercial with them. Don't edit them and put edits up on YouTube or any other website, and also no written transcripts, even if they're for your own personal use. Be sure to read our full copyright statement at the bottom of all of our website pages, including those for OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, which is our parent. We appreciate that. And then also remember, we are a 501c3 nonprofit with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, and we are supported by those of you who do contribute to us. That's what keeps us going on the Space Show, keeps our content distributed totally for free. So we do ask for your support. Remember, if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction for your gift. The same is true if you are a California taxpayer. In California, we are a public benefit corporation. And then very quickly, remember, we do have sponsors, and please from time to time check out their banner ads going across the website. And since we're on the 60-minute format, I just want to mention our sponsors and thank them very much for our sponsor group. And that this includes the Space Finance Group, Orbital ATK, the Space Foundation. And I remind everybody that I am one of the moderators of a panel at their symposium this year. I think my panel is the last day, April 6th, in Colorado Springs, but more about that on a different program. And then AIAA is a sponsor, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, and Orbital ATK. And we appreciate all of our sponsors very, very much. And I want to introduce our guest to you. So we are honored today to have Dr. Phil Lubin with us. And he is a physics professor at UC Santa Barbara. And his primary research has been focused on study of the early universe in the millimeter wavelength bands, as well as applications of directed energy for planetary defense, as well as relativistic propulsion. He has a website that you should definitely check out, deepspace.ucsb.edu. And his full bio is on the website, and I urge you to read it. But again, I want to maximize our time talking with Dr. Lubin. So check it out for yourself, but do note that Dr. Lubin is the PI for the Starshot Project, which is a NASA project, And we, as I said, are very, very honored to have him with us for an hour today. Welcome to the Space Show, Dr. Lubin. How are you?
Good. I have to make a quick correction. So the NASA program, which is currently in a phase two, is called the Deep In, just like it sounds, DEEP-IN, which you'll find on our website. Starshot is a separate program funded by the Breakthrough Foundation. It's not a NASA program. The NASA program we have is for a directed energy relativistic wafer-scale spacecraft program, which, of course, sounds a lot like the Breakthrough Foundation project. And that's because they're very synergistic. But the NASA program precedes Breakthrough by about a year and a half, and you'll find all the information on our NASA program on our website as well as in our papers. The Breakthrough Foundation is starting the Starshot program, and we've been with some preliminary testing this year. But the NASA program is currently in a phase two that I can also talk about.
And there's three phases to the NASA program. Is that correct?
So in the NASA program we're in, it's a run out of the NIAC office, which is the Advanced Concepts Office, and that has a two-phase program. We passed through the phase one, starting with a proposal in 2014. Breakthrough found out about our work after we presented, sent them a paper of our NASA program in late 2015, which is what sort of kicked off the Starshot program. But we received a second phase of NASA funding earlier in 2016, last year, and we'll have that through 2018. So the NASA program is nominally a two-phase program. We're in the second phase of that. Where we go after that depends on interest as well as technical progress, which there's a lot of technical work going on at the moment that I can talk about. Starshot program is just sort of gearing up at this point. Started in full form in terms of technology development, which is getting going.
So tell us what this project or projects are all about in terms of interstellar flight. So why don't we start out with getting a brief introduction from you?
Sure. So it looks easy in the movies. We're all used to pushing the big knob on the panel and going to warp factor, whatever. And then we zoom across the galaxy or wherever we're going pretty quickly. But in reality, we don't have a way of doing that. And so the reality is going to even the nearest star, stellar region, for example, the Alpha Centauri region, is vastly different than is shown in the movies. No matter how productive and beautiful it may appear in the movies, we just do not have that technology. And hopefully someone will develop it, or will be given it by some advanced civilization. But at the moment, we're pathetically far behind in our ability to get to the speeds that are required. So we started looking at this as an outgrowth of our Directed Energy Planetary Defense Program, which started back in 2009, and looked at what could one do to defend the planet against asteroids and comets. From a perspective of sort of advanced directed energy systems, which are being developed for other purposes. And that's sort of what spun up this entire process out of that study of looking at what could we do to defend the planet with directed energy. We also spun an effort off to look at what we could do to achieve relativistic flight, which is essentially the same kind of system, namely a large-scale directed energy or a laser array, if you will, to produce an extremely high-power beam that's very tightly focused, and in the same way that we would defend the planet by using it to heat asteroids to their vaporization point and deflect them, we could also use that same beam to push on a reflector, not by heating it and not by ejecting material, but simply by using the light, the photons, to pound against the reflector the same way that water being shot from a hose onto a balloon pushes the balloon away. Well, light has the same effect. It carries momentum and energy with it and can push a reflector away. And if you have a strong enough light source, you can actually propel an object. And the only speed limit in that case is the speed of light. It's very different than conventional propulsion, whether it's chemical propulsion, ion engine, fission, thermal engine, or even fusion engines, as you mentioned was in the recent movie. And those engines are good for going relatively modest speeds, but they're not good for going at relativistic speeds. Even fusion engines, which people often, you know, pull out of somewhere and say, well, this must be the solution because it sounds really cool. You know, when you look at the details of fusion engines, you realize that even if we have them, which we don't, but even if we have them, the energy released in a fusion reaction is less than 1% of the rest mass energy. But this is what kills you. You have to carry the fuel with you and all the auxiliary mass to contain the fusion reaction and to react it. When you look at that in detail, you find that fusion really is not a good option for going at relativistic speeds, as much as we would like it to be. It's an option, and there have been a number of studies looking at the viability of fusion. But what you're always left with in the end is an absolutely enormous spacecraft, vastly larger than something like the shuttle program, and the speeds are still pretty modest. So it's not really a solution for the moment. You know, the best propellants really are two propellants. One would be an antimatter annihilation engine, which would be as good as we know that we can do with the physics that we know about, barring some sort of mysterious warp drive, which doesn't exist at the moment, or, you know, wormholes, which might offer another way, but we don't know how to make wormholes. But when you look at what is possible, an antimatter annihilation engine is one possibility, at least it's real, in the sense of being able to think about the physics for it. What we don't know how to do, however, is to produce the antimatter in sufficient quantities, nor do we know how to react it and confine it with a small enough auxiliary mass to be, make a spacecraft useful. So two major problems with antimatter. Hopefully we will solve those eventually. The other one, which is the one that we chose for our NASA program and the Starshot is choosing, is to use directed energy and not carry the engine with you at all, but rather leave the engine back home and simply use the energy from the engine, which in our case is a laser array, to illuminate a reflector, and effectively the exhaust then is coming off at the speed of light because it is light. And there is no engine because you're not carrying any mass with you to produce that light. You're actually leaving the light source at home. So totally different paradigm. It'd be like launching a space shuttle and the engine sat on the launch pad, never left the launch pad, and just shot the space shuttle up. But that, of course, is not how the space shuttle works.
What if you're on the flight? This shows you that I don't know anything about what you're talking about. But if you're on the flight and you need power and you've left the engine at home, I mean, how far out will the beam reach, or what does the chip or whatever the vehicle is do for added power if it needs added power?
Right. Well, you could either call the auto club either a tow or, a jump start. Of course, you can't at the moment, although that might be a nice business to think about. Actually, on board, we carry a small radioactive power source, basically a radioactive battery called an RTG, which stands for a radioisotope thermal generator. Such devices, much larger versions of these, are already on the Voyager mission and on a number of the Martians, well, at least on the Mars Curiosity. On the rover, you'll see a number of RTGs. If you just Google, RTG Martian rover, you'll come to the Jet or Voyager. So we have a very tiny one on board, and what we've focused on in the NASA program is very, very low mass spacecraft, kind of pushing the spacecraft to current technological limits, which is to place an entire spacecraft on a wafer. And that allows us to achieve masses which are, really tiny compared to what you would think of as a spacecraft. For example, the Voyager mission is, hundreds of kilograms, whereas the spacecraft, what we're looking at, are literally in the gram level. It's a are all contained on a wafer. So on that wafer is a very small radioactive battery that does provide the power during the cruise phase. Once you get to the target, which is a star, then you can use photovoltaics on board to add additional power.
How far out does the beam go from, is it located on Earth or is it in orbit, or where do you locate the beam propulsion unit?
There's a number of options, and you can find all the gory details in a paper called a Roadmap to Interstellar Flight, which is a 70-plus page paper on our website or on the archive. Just Google it, a Roadmap to Interstellar Flight, and you'll find it. Our name in there, you'll see. The beam, so the laser does not stay on, does not propel the spacecraft continuously during its flight. It's only on for a couple of minutes, and then it's turned off. So it's much like, hitting a baseball. The time at which the bat is pushing on the baseball is a very, very short period of time, a fraction of a second. After that, the baseball just takes off and it's gone. And the same thing happens here. You turn on the laser for a short period of time, you shoot these things out near the speed of light, a reasonable fraction of speed of light, and 2 minutes later you turn off the laser and it's gone. And the reason you turn off the laser is because the spacecraft is so far away after being illuminated for nominally a couple of minutes that it does very, very little good to leave on the laser, because the laser beam has diverged or expanded so much that it's not being useful anymore. So then you go to the next launch. And that's another paradigm shift. Not only are you not carrying the engine with you, but you only provide electrical power to the launch system, which in our case is this laser array, and you can launch spacecraft relatively quickly. So these wafers literally can be launched every, a couple hundred seconds if you want, and you could launch more than 100 of them per day. So the spacecraft are cheap. The launch system is expensive, however. The laser array is very expensive, very complicated. But the spacecraft, you mass produce, and they're extremely inexpensive when you mass produce them.
What kind of energy does the laser require, and do we have that type of energy capability today?
This array would be vastly larger than anything that we've built to date. It has a power, a peak power of a, it depends on how you design the system. This is one of the things that your audience might want to do is go to our website, the deepspace.ucsb.edu website, and look under projects, and you'll find the NASA program as well as the Starshot program. And there is a web calculator that allows you to design your own missions. You can answer a lot of the questions that you're asking now. How long does it take? How fast you go, how much energy does it take, how much power do you need, how long is it on for, things like that. And you can literally design your own mission. It's a kind of a fun thing to do, sit down and not have to worry about doing the mathematics yourself. You already get it for you. So the amount of power needed actually is similar to the power that a conventional spacecraft uses when launched from the surface of the Earth. So, for example, the shuttle, when it used to take off, had a power up launch pad of around 30 to 50 gigawatts, or a gigawatt is a billion watts. Well, that was in chemical power. So the shuttle was launched by a combination of solid rocket boosters, which were an aluminum compound that was being oxidized, as well as the hydrogen-oxygen main engines, which are the center engines on the shuttle. But that chemistry provided power. We don't normally think of the chemical power in a launch vehicle in terms of watts. We usually just rate it in terms of pounds of lift or newtons of lift. But if you calculate the power, you find that it's roughly a border of 50 gigawatts. And we need about the same power level to send these small spacecraft at relativistic speed. The space shuttle, of course, was massive by comparison, of order many, many, many tons. 50 tons or so. The space shuttle, of course, is going much slower. So the trade-off between the two is really mass for speed. But we're not using chemistry to power the system. We're using the equivalent power, converting electricity into light, using a laser array. It's not a single laser. It's actually a large number of laser amplifiers that are arrayed together, much like a parallel processor in a computer. They're synchronized, and then they behave as one very large laser, even though there are a large number of relatively small laser amplifiers. But we need about that power. We need between 10, the system design, between 10 gigawatts and 100 gigawatts of power. There's nothing like that currently. But the way that we're building the system is not to build one gigantic laser, but rather to combine a large number, relatively modest, 100-watt lasers, a kilowatt each, but many, many of them. And so in that sense, we're much like the way you build a supercomputer, the way you build a GPU, a graphics processing unit today. You take, in the case of a supercomputer, you take of order 100,000, almost up to a million now, individual CPUs, much like in your desktop, your laptop computer. You synchronize them, you get them together so they know what they're doing synchronized, and then you have a supercomputer. That's how all supercomputers are made now, by having a lot of very tiny computers that are operating in parallel. So a laser array is actually the same sort of design in an analogy with the parallel processing supercomputer. You have many laser amplifiers that are parallel together, synchronized, and then they form this very powerful super laser, if you want to think about it that way. Not a word that we normally use, but you can think about the same analogy.
You have an email question from John in Denver, and he says, David, I'm at work, so I'm using email. And he says, aside from financial or funding issues, where are the technology challenges or roadblocks, given where we are today with the TRL, and where we would need to be to at least have some sort of demonstration unit to verify the work?
Yeah, great question. Depends on, the TRL is the technology readiness level, which is used a lot in NASA and other aerospace industries to decide, is a technology ready to be launched? Of course, in our case, you know, we're not launching the lasers at high speed, or laser amplifiers. We're using the laser amplifiers to launch, you know, a small spacecraft at high speed. So the question is still a great one. In either case, we have two basic choices. One is to put the...
Dr. Lubin, did I lose you? Hello? I may have lost him, and I may need to call him back.
You want me to continue on with the... discussion of the question that was asked.
Yeah, please, on where we are with TRLs and challenges today.
Yeah.
and zeroing out funding.
Yeah, okay. So the primary issues at the moment are, if it's a space-based system, in other words, put the array in orbit or on the moon or, you know, someplace that's far away from the surface of the Earth, then we have a different set of concerns than if it's a ground-based system. So the NASA program is focusing more on a space-based deployment of the array, and the Starship program is focusing on a ground-based deployment. And the reason that affects the TRL level is that, as anyone can imagine, putting a car in space is very different than putting a car in your garage, and the TRL is a very different concern. So let's just focus on the technologies that are key. The key technologies are the laser amplifiers, which have to be synchronized. They run in what's called a master oscillator power amplifier, or MOPA, configuration, similar to a phased array in a radar system. The keys are maintaining phase coherence across the many elements, and there are many, many elements in this kind of system, up to a billion in some configuration. And the other is the ability of the laser amplifiers to have long enough coherence length to allow you to form a synthesized beam on the target, to push it, maintain a tight beam on the target, to push it hard enough long enough to get to high speeds. So there are currently laser amplifiers already that work quite well. A lot of this program owes its roots to DOD work in this area for producing high efficiency, modest power lasers. And we're this is an interesting a combination of people in this program that come from very different roots. But that's one area, is getting the laser amplifiers to not to produce power. We already actually have quite good efficiency, nearly a little bit above 40% efficiency now. So that'll improve, but it already is good enough. One of the key areas that we're working on is increasing the coherence for the amplifiers, and there's a technical reason why the higher power amplifiers, which are around a kilowatt each, have smaller coherence length. We'd like to have long coherence length, which is pushing us to lower power. None of those have flown in space in the high power configuration, so in terms of TRL for space, that's a key technological driver for space-based array, for ground-based array. That's not the case. But the main issue really is not the laser amplifier, but it's really maintaining the phase coherence across an enormous array of laser amplifiers. And when you look at the issues related to that, such as phase noise in the various interconnects, we're largely a fiber-based system, a fiber optic interconnect. We have to keep the phase noise in the fibers and the secondary auxiliary elements, such as phase shifters and splitters, many things that are particular to a fiber optic environment. We have to not only keep those the phase noise low, we have to understand and correct for it. For a ground-based system, we also have to mitigate the atmosphere. The atmosphere, as you know, when you look at the star, has perturbations or variations in it due to thermal effects primarily. A little bit from wind, but mostly thermal effects. We get turbulence in the atmosphere. So we have to have a very sophisticated adaptive optics program. However, the system by itself is already an intrinsic adaptive optics system. Every sub-element is a phase-controlled sub-element. So in a sense, we're sort of the ideal adaptive optics program. So really the major stumbling point right now is to be able to combine the laser amplifiers into a synthesized beam. And it's not the amplifier itself, although we are working on long coherence arrangements and also highly integrated arrangements of the system. So that's one key technological area, maintaining phase coherence across large apertures, which for us large aperture means 1 to 10 kilometers in thought. So that's a challenge. And then the other relates to the spacecraft side, having ultra-low mass against the surface density reflectors. So we're looking at new materials, you know, carbon-based materials, carbon nanotubes, graphene, new types of polymers and glasses. That's a challenge, although it's not an insurmountable challenge. We already have some very good candidate materials. And then third would be the spacecraft itself, maintaining all the functionality of a reasonable spacecraft. Minimal would be imaging capability once you get to the target. And then the other challenge for the spacecraft is to communicate the data back to the Earth. And the only way we know how to do this is via laser communication systems. So there's a small laser communication system on board the spacecraft. And then that is sent back to the Earth and received by the same system that transmits the power to propel the system in the first place. You can actually run it in reverse to receive the data. And this is all discussed in gory detail in this very long technical paper, this roadmap to interstellar flight. So if those of you listening are interested in the details, definitely urge you to look at that, as well as go to our website. There's a lot of papers on our website. We have nearly 50 papers now on various aspects of the technology.
A couple of other notes from listeners. Beverly is in Seattle, and she says, I'm trying to visualize the wafers that you're talking about. So if I look at the mini little chip that goes into my cell phone, is that what you're talking about? Is that the size?
not quite. That's a good analogy. Your cell phone itself would be a better analogy if you think about your cell phone. The cell phone that you use has a transmission system, not a laser transmission, but a radio link, which is how you communicate, how I'm communicating at the moment. It also has a camera, both a stills and a movie camera. It has all kinds of sensors on board, has magnetometers, gyros, accelerometers. It has a CPU. It has, admittedly, not a radioactive battery. It has a stamp that would probably not be in good shape if they had exploding radioactive batteries. Wouldn't go well. But you basically have a spacecraft in your cell phone, and there actually have been flights of cell phones in space. Literally, the cell phone itself, not stripped down, but just the cell phone with a little modification. And the reason this program is possible at all is because electronics is on an exponential growth curve. What people sometimes refer to as Moore's Law, in that we are growing exponentially. We double in capability approximately every year and a half to 2 years in the electronics industry. Similar growth is happening and has happened in the photonics industry. Photonics is like electronics. Electronics really means comes from electrons. In electronics, you're manipulating electrons on materials to produce your circuits. In photonics, you're manipulating photons or light. And so there's actually an interesting analogy which you'll paper if you look at the growth of photonics. Over the last 25 years, it also has been on an exponential growth curve with a doubling approximately every 18 months. And that's the reason that we can even begin to speak about this technology today. It's because we are in a exponentially growing technological arena in both the electronics on the spacecraft and the photonics for the laser array or the directed energy system. Without that exponential growth, this would not be possible. And that's something I think for your listeners to ponder. If you think about rockets, kind of go back in time to the 1930s and look at the state of rocketry in the early 1930s and before, and then in the late 1930s as World War II started. And you'll see that the rockets that were used during World War II, particularly by Germany, bear a somewhat striking resemblance to the rockets of today, 70 years later. And the reason is because rocketry is not on an exponential growth curve at all. It's actually rather slowly growing. And when you look at the basics of rocketry, namely the chemical reactions that happen in rocket propulsion, the chemistry, while it is different today than it was, say, 1,000 years ago when people were mixing up a little bit of carbon and sulfur and nitrate compounds to make what you might call fireworks today, small rockets. The chemistry is really, in terms of energy released per unit mass or per unit volume of chemicals, hasn't changed very much in 1,000 years. And that's why chemical-based propulsion will not get you to the stars. It will get you Mars, as we sometimes say, but it's not going to get you to the stars because, first of all, it's incredibly inefficient. It has less than one part per billion of energy released compared to the rest mass energy of the constituents you start with. And we have no known way to increase the chemical reaction efficiency. We can't engineer the chemistry at this point. We don't know how to do it. So this is really where the root of the problem occurs. If you want to go very fast, you have to start with propulsion that comes out of the exhaust very fast. And that's the problem. In chemistry, it doesn't come out very fast. And even in ion engines, which comes out about 10 times faster currently, still not fast enough. So these are technical problems, and some people may or may not be interested in them, but if you want to go at relativistic speeds, if you want to go to the stars, you cannot do it with chemistry. And there's only two known solutions. As I mentioned, one's antimatter, annihilation engine, and the other is directed energy.
You have another email question from medical doctor, Doug, in Southern California, it seems to me that at night the unused electricity generating potential of the United States might be in the neighborhood of 700 gigawatts. Might we be able to send much larger payloads if lasers were to be attached at various points to the grid?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, whoever asked that. As were all the questions so far, it's really insightful audience. So, yeah, as I mentioned, the amount of power for the small spacecraft is of the order of 100 gigawatts. What if you want to send a larger spacecraft? What if you want to send a human-capable spacecraft? You know, what would it take? And that is also discussed in our paper. There's a trade-off between speed and laser array power and laser array size and the size of the payload that you're sending. There's a series of connections between the two. So just to give you some examples, photonic propulsion or using light to propel spacecraft scales very differently than does chemistry or fusion or ion engines, which are all essentially very limited by the propellant you carry on board to a, you know, kind of an upper limit speed. Whereas in photonic propulsion, as you change the mass, you change the speed sometimes, you know, quite dramatically. So if you wanted to send, for example, use the same array, you built one array, and you wanted it to send out a wide variety of spacecraft, you could send out any mass of spacecraft. Again, more masses is slower. So, for example, if you take that same array that can be used to shoot a wafer to the stars, you can also use that same array to send a 1 kilogram package to Mars the same day. It'll get to Mars about 8 hours later, and you'll have to slow it down and get to Mars with another array on Mars. Or you can send a 10 kilogram package to Mars and get it there, you know, overnight express. Or you could send a 100-ton package to Mars, which would be a human-capable spacecraft, a very large one, about 10 times the mass of the Orion capsule, by the way. And that would take roughly about 4 weeks. It takes about a month to get to Mars. So the same array is actually useful for a wide variety, essentially an, you know, infinite variety of spacecraft. You don't build a special array for every spacecraft at all. You build one array, and then you apply it to the spacecraft that you want. And that same array can also be used to defend the planet against any known threat. Any asteroid that we currently think is a problem can be mitigated by the same technology. You don't change it. You just, instead of targeting a spacecraft, you target an asteroid. There's a lot of things you can do with it.
So,
As to their question about the 700 gigawatt, yeah, they're right. The power, the average power in the United States, if you sum up everything, you know, when it's on full blast, is about 1,000 gigawatts. That's sort of the limit of the U.S. grid at the moment. And, of course, we're using a lot of that, you know, for things which are necessary. So you don't want to divert your grid to, you know, sending a spacecraft and all the lights go out. So in our case, for the ground-based version, the Breakthrough Foundation version, we're looking at producing the power either by conventional means with a photovoltaic array or a generator of either a diesel or gas or, you know, anything. Basically, we just need electricity. We then store that electrical energy in a battery bank, and then we turn it on for a few minutes, perhaps once per day or once every few days, and use the energy to power the laser. But we don't use, on average, 100 gigawatts. We simply store the power and then use it as needed. So we could get away with a vastly lower amount of power coming in, just that we don't use the power continuously. We store it, and then we use it for a brief period of time to send out a spacecraft. But you're right, you know, the numbers are not outrageous compared to human capability. So currently we're already in the U.S. at 1,000 gigawatts. If we wanted to build another 10 or 20% beyond that, we could then run such an array continuously. So it's, you know, obviously an ambitious program, But it's not beyond the scope of human capabilities at all. We already use much more than 100 gigawatts today in terms of our industrial and residential uses. For space, the simplest answer that we're looking at is use a large photovoltaic array. So again, either storing using lower average power, or build a full array, which would be a very large array, of course. And the nice thing about this program is you can use the sun's light to power the system, which then sends out light to propel a spacecraft to another sun, if you will. So, some nice romantic way of thinking about spacecraft evolution in that sense. It's all light dependent rather than chemistry dependent.
Carl's in Tucson, and he says, for the beginning exploration with these wafers, what would be the relativistic speed that it could get to, and how close could you ultimately get to the speed of light? And is there any hope down the road, maybe a couple of hundred years, that humans could actually make an interstellar flight?
Yeah, great question. The technical details are in the paper, or use our calculator, and you can actually, you can do sort of exactly what you might want to do, which is design, say, a 100-ton spacecraft, which is, of the order of a shuttle mission, or kind of design something you think would be reasonable to carry humans to the stars, and then, design your own array, and you can actually figure out how fast it goes. And the bottom line is that, yes, this technology is scalable, so that once you build one of these arrays, once we master the technology required, we can then go on and build much larger ones. Since our technology is growing exponentially, this makes sense to think about the long-term implications. This is one area where people really fail, myself included, we fail to understand what happens when we're in exponentially growing technological areas versus not. So if the technology is doubling every 2 years, and say you wait 100 years as you develop the technology, you don't wait, but you evolve over 100 years, well, that's 50 doubling. 2 to the 50th power is, that would be a million billion. It's just a phenomenal number to think about. Now, it's not, we're going to, saturate at some point. We're not going to keep growing forever at the rate we are, but we are currently still in this very, very rapid exponential growth phase. So, yes, the answer to your question is yes. You can certainly on paper, do it right now. You could design a system which could propel 100 tons, 1,000 tons, whatever you want at as high speed as you want. But as close as you can get, it's simply a trade-off. In practice, however, I think there's another problem. Is that, I know we love this idea of sending humans to the stars to explore, but I'm not convinced that we are the right things to be exploring out in interstellar space. We're great at exploring our planet and see what a struggle it is to just get to Mars, but I'm not at all convinced that we're the right things to be going out, as you see in the movies, to the stars. So unless I've thought about it, but I just don't quite see humanity as kind of the right package to do this. Kind of look at yourself and you think about how much of yourself is useful for exploration on an interplanetary or interstellar scale. Most of our body is designed to run away through the jungle or through the street. We're designed to escape, some sort of predator, if you will. Our brain is a very small portion of our body, and most of the metabolic consumption, goes into things which are not the brain, although the brain is not a trivial portion of it. But certainly, in terms of mass and in terms of maintenance, if you think about how much food you need per day, just roughly of order a kilogram of food plus water per day just to survive, humans are not great. I think we have to think very carefully about this issue of how do we evolve humanity to possibly, more futuristic versions of humanity where, you know, perhaps we become a combined biological and mechanical system, or we place artificial intelligence in our mechanical systems to explore robotically for us. I know it's not as romantic. I really understand that. And it's a very great disappointment, you know, when I talk to people. It's, oh, man, that's, you know, I just want to go out and explore myself. It's like on Star Trek or one of the other beautiful things that we see on the media. But it's a lot harder when you do the math and you realize, wow, people are really high maintenance. They require a lot of things to get them to where they want to go and keep them alive. So I think there are other ways, and it's something that we need to ponder. And we have a little part of our program at the moment looking at biological systems that could withstand interstellar flight and still go into a sleep mode, kind of like in the recent movie, and then wake up when they get to the destination. And there are such things biologically that look promising. So we're exploring that. I realize it's not as doesn't fulfill the romantic dream that we all have.
You've got several more emails.
Go ahead. Let's go.
Bijan is in Sweden, and he says, after acceleration to relativistic speed, could the laser beam support the spacecraft afterwards in order to finally adjust its trajectory or powering its instruments and communication during and after the flyby instead of using the RTG on board?
What a great question. So it's on page, I don't know, 67 in the roadmap. Actually there's a plot in the paper on how much really flux, how much power per unit area you get as a function of distance. And there's a discussion. Yes, you can actually use the same laser to power the spacecraft, recharge the batteries on the spacecraft if you don't want to fly a radioactive battery. Although there is a very long discussion about the radioactive battery in the paper as well. So there is you can actually power things out to quite large distances. So it looks to me like it's possible to get out to about a light year and still be able to power the spacecraft. But I don't see that as an effective use of the system because you're putting in 100 gigawatts on the ground or more. And then, you know, by the time the beam is spread out and you're receiving it, you're receiving a very, very tiny fraction of that, much less than 1 watt. So it seems like a highly inefficient way to do it. I think the right way to think about this is that, you know, there are three critical phases to the launch and mission. One is the launch phase. You have to launch it successfully. Then you have the cruise phase where, you know, not much is going on. There's some things to look at and you'd like to measure. Radiation and, other things, dust levels, dust impacts going out. But largely you're kind of in a sleep mode. And then you are more interested once you get to the target. But once you get to the target, you have light from the star. If you didn't get to the star, you missed your target anyway, so it probably doesn't matter. So in the paper we discussed this, that you really only need a very small battery on board, a radioactive battery, to handle the cruise phase. And once you get to the target, you can use the light from the target, which even on the wafer, the amount of light you would get from a typical star at a distance that you might imagine a planet of interest to be at, is still quite large compared to the radioactive battery on board.
Bijan sent in another note. Could a lens in space be used to refocus the laser beam and prolong the acceleration of the spacecraft?
Yes. So Robert Ford did some interesting work back in the 1980s looking at precisely that question. In the 1980s, we didn't have laser arrays or any way to really produce the laser power. It was just a kind of a paper study of what if, whereas we're focusing much more on not just what if, but, you know, here's how, too. But what Robert Ford did was look at large Fresnel lenses in space. By large, these were 100 plus kilometer diameter lenses, which, you know, we don't know how to make, and that would be a monumental engineering project in itself. But yes, you can imagine very large lenses in space, you'd have to trade off the cost of building the lens and keeping it on the target with the cost of building a larger laser system. And it is a trade-off. So it is. These are all very interesting trade-offs too. And I think it's important to note that what people say today is impossible to do. You know, you just want to go back in history maybe 50 years and see who used the word impossible and just see how wrong they were. So I wouldn't say it's impossible. I don't use that word. I would just say it's very, very difficult to do, and we need other solutions to be able to do that. But a good question and a great thought. You're thinking in the right direction.
Doug sent in another note. Could the sail be designed in such a way that it would passively stay within the beam, perhaps a shuttlecock configuration?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we're actually looking at various designs for stable systems that will, as we call it, beam follow. So as the laser beam is perturbed slightly, whether it's by the atmosphere or by phase variations in the system itself, the beam is not perfectly stable. We want the spacecraft to kind of follow the beam. So the various geometries we've looked at, and in our roadmap paper, we actually talk about producing a geometry which has a kind of a null in the middle. So not just a shaping of the spacecraft itself, and your analogy of the shuttlecock is a good analogy. The shuttlecock design looks much like a warhead design or a projectile design, by the way. And you could see it from either way, but it's a good analogy you're thinking about there. So, you want, the moment we're looking at designs where the beam is profiled, a beam profile, and luckily because we have a large number of beams that we combine together, we can profile quite nicely. And then you want to have a stable geometry for the sail itself. The picture we show in our paper of a flat one we discussed is not. That's just an artistic rendering. You don't want a flat design for the sail at all. You want something that's curved. So we have, we've talked about bubble designs for a couple of years now. Some people have been looking, the Harvard group has been looking at spheres, which we've also looked at. We're also looking at parabolic sections and hyperbolic sections and all kinds of interesting designs that are either blown, expanded to be rigid, or have a small infrastructure behind them. And it's very complicated for the design. Beam following reflector, but to design one that's low enough mass. And that's very much one of the challenges.
You have another email from Alice, who is in Boston. And Alice says, when David got back from the film festival in early December, he talked about your talk quite a bit and said that you would be coming on the space show. He mentioned that the probable speed of the wafers would be about a third the speed of light. So if we're looking at going to Alpha Centauri, maybe a 10-year round trip to get the data or the images back, that's about the time it took for New Horizons to get to Pluto. But there's quite a bit of difference, right? So I guess it's a comment from Alice more than a question.
Sure. So our goal in the NASA program is around 25% speed of light, 20-30% speed of light is one of our targets. It's a very ambitious target, obviously, compared to anything that's flown before. And this is a very long-term program. This is not a 10-year development program at all. This is a generational program. I'm not going to be alive myself when this thing comes to fruition. But you're looking at probably 30-plus years of development. But we're on this very nice exponential growth curve. In terms of time, if you were traveling at 25% speed of light, one quarter of speed of light, the nearest exoplanet to us is in the Alpha Centauri region, so called Proxima B planet, which was discovered recently. So that's a little over 4 light years away. So if you were traveling at a quarter of the speed of light, and you take your 4 light year distance and divide by the fraction of speed of light you're at, in that case, in this case, one quarter, so then you'd end up with 16 years to get there. And then if it takes kind of a minimum in a case like this would be 20 years from the time you launched to the time you got a picture back or whatever data you're going to get back. But of course, in those 20 years, unlike, say, a Voyager mission or a New Horizons mission, you're not doing nothing. In those 20 years, you could have launched 20 million, literally, more spacecraft. Because, again, you're only putting in electricity and the spacecraft are the cheap part, unlike the current paradigm when spacecraft are very expensive. Spacecraft are cheap, and the launcher is expensive. You can send out lots of spacecraft. So I think this is something you want to think about, is that suppose the cost of the spacecraft are very low and you can launch many per day, what would you do? You would not just sit around waiting for the data to come back 20 years later. You would be saying, okay, I just sent out the first one. Let me send out, 10,000 more or a million more or 10 million more. And it becomes, a completely different paradigm. Imagine they produce one cell phone in the world and everyone came to look at it in the museum. Not very useful. What you want to do is produce billions of them so people can communicate. In a similar case here, you want to produce huge numbers of these spacecraft and use them not only for interstellar flight, but for planetary missions, for environmental sensing, perhaps on the Earth. There's all kinds of things you can do with low-cost sensors that become interconnected. So you can have swarms of them, you can have mesh geometry. Quite an interesting set of possibilities.
You mentioned that you didn't think you'd be around when this project came to fruition. During your lifetime, how far do you foresee this project getting? When I met you, you seemed like a pretty young guy. So I would think you'd have several decades left to accomplish a lot. So where would you be at the end of your lifetime, do you think?
Well, my focus right now is not to be alive for the first mission. My focus right now is to try to enable the stumbling blocks in the development so that we can come to a positive conclusion about where we're going. So we've had a number of people look at this proposal and pass through a couple of NASA committees, and while it's not a program that we expect NASA to embrace in terms of an immediate interstellar mission, it is something which has a very long-term potential, and in that sense, very different. I think in the next 20 to 30, well, really in the next 10 years, I expect that we'll get to the point where we'll kind of very, very, have very detailed answers to the questions that we're trying to figure out, phase stability, atmospheric perturbation, mitigation, sail design, spacecraft design. We're already beginning on that. In our lab today, we have small spacecraft that are the size of a quarter, for example. We have image sensors, laser, comm on board. We're already going well in that, going nicely in that direction. We're producing, we have a 25-kilometer fiber line in our laboratory, which is actually rather easy to do in fiber. You just coil it up onto a big spool, and you have, 25 kilometers of you can hold in your hand, literally. So we're already using longer lines than we anticipate in a real system, and that gives us a tremendous advantage in testing. This is a collaboration with several other institutions, national labs, and there's a lot of interest in seeing how far you can push this and where the stumbling blocks are and what new technologies we need to develop. So I'm hoping the next 10 years we'll have very solid answers, which I'm hoping the next 2 years we'll have some really good results on phase perturbations in our laboratories. But then to go to the next level, you really want to start building arrays, and that begins to take the money. I think it's very much a roadmap. If you look in our paper, you see this thing is laid out as here are the key stumbling blocks that we need to solve. Here, in the parlance, the first question, here are the TRLs that are low, not just the physical technology, but the underlying understanding of how do the systems interact together. What is the beam synthesis look like? How rapidly does it change? How do we close the loop on the system to keep it stable? Those are things that keep me up at night that we are concentrating on now, rather than, you know, going out, we're not rushing out to build a 100 gigawatt array today, which, by the way, just references about 1 million times larger in power than the largest directed energy array currently being used in the DOD. But we are focusing on the core technological problems that building such an array would encounter. And key among them is this issue of, say, of synthesizing the beam over a kilometer to 10 kilometer scale. So I anticipate, assuming I live a nominal lifetime, that, you know, towards the end of my life, either people have found, you know, what was wrong in the whole system that we don't see at the moment, but maybe someone will find, you know, a key problem we just forgot about. I urge you to think hard about it. But it's passed through a lot of hands at this point. Or we'll discover what are the problems that we need to develop new technologies for. And we already know what some of the problems are, and they are very much on the economic side. In order to build such a system, we have to be able to afford to build such a system. And that means we have to push hard on the highly integrated infrastructure required. So if you imagine, you take your cell phone, and imagine going in there into the cell phone and counting, which you'd have to do under an electron microscope, or at least a high-power optical microscope. You know, you have to tear it apart and figure out how many resistors are in there, how many transistors, you know, and then go ahead and build up, you know, go to the store and buy all those resistors and transistors and try to put together a cell phone. You know, it'd probably end up costing you, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. You know, have a...
We're sorry. All circuits are busy now. Will you please try your...
I've never heard that one before. Listeners, I'll try to get him right back.
Okay.
We're back. Listeners, sorry about that. But can you pick up where you left off before Verizon or whatever cut us off?
Yeah, I have AT&T in this case. Right, so I think it's very important to look at things around you, such as your computer, your cell phone, your, Xbox, your game stations, whatever, and imagine, or even your car, and imagine you had to build that yourself and there wasn't mass production, there wasn't, large plants that integrate these things for you. You could not do it. The reason that cell phones exist, the reason computers exist, the reason that our modern digital world is like it is because we're on an exponential growth in those technologies, and we've mastered mass production to the point where the cost dropped to the point that we can afford it. But, you know, if you just go back 50 years when the space program was, you know, really going very nicely in the mid-1960s, they go back to the year 1967, we were getting ready getting ready to go to the moon. And look at the state of electronics in 1967 compared to the state of electronics today. And you'll find a vast difference from 1967 to today. Look at the state of the space program in terms of rocket design, spacecraft design, and you'll see there is relatively little change from 1967 to today. And in fact, most of the change is because of the electronics, not because of the propellant system. And again, that's the difference between an exponential technology and a non-exponential technology. So, in your everyday life, you literally have the rudimentary parts of the spacecraft you carried around, and every smartphone is essentially a spacecraft. And, it's not too hard to imagine that if you wanted to strip down a smartphone into its core components and, you know, take away the screen, the things that, you know, are the human interactive portion, just reduce it down to the bare silicon and gallium arsenide inside, you would, you know, basically all fit on your fingertip and have a mass, you know, vastly below 1 gram. And the heaviest thing in there would be your battery. And so that's kind of where we are. We're looking at a very different way of building spacecraft, but also a completely different way of designing propulsion systems so that we don't actually carry the propellant with us. And that combination is what will allow us to get to relativistic speeds. But again, that same system, namely the, you know, propellant, the directed energy propulsion system, allows you to use that for other masses, not just tiny things, but you can use it for large scale, large masses, just at lower speed. So there's also an interplanetary portion of this program. You want to get to Mars rapidly, and the numbers I quoted for getting to Mars were things which are realistic to think about. If you had this system, you could shoot things back and forth to Mars very, very quickly, including people. And the people are not going to get there in, 30 minutes, in spite of what the news said about our work. But you can imagine sending packages to Mars quickly, and imagine sending people to Mars relatively quickly in a quarter of weeks or so, a month. But anyway, it opens a completely different world, both in what you can do and in how rapidly you can do it and the number of things you can send out.
Judy in Chicago sent in a note and said there's lots of talk about backing or cloning humans up on some kind of a hard drive or a chip. So I'm wondering if you could back up or clone human intelligence or maybe artificial intelligence in combination with human characteristics and send us as individuals out on an interstellar mission.
Yeah, so we ran a program last year called the Voices of Humanity program to try to get the public literally on board. We wanted to collect from everybody on the Earth information that they wanted to send out as sort of a message or have them as an emissary, including digital DNA and pictures and documents and poems and tweets and, whatever you could imagine you might want to deliver out into the universe. Some of these would go on board the spacecraft because there's room on the spacecraft for digital data. And we could literally currently we can carry tweets from every single person on the planet on a tiny portion of our spacecraft. Soon we'll be able to carry, full HD movies from every person on the planet. And so that becomes, I think, interesting for people to ponder, the way in which we're able to take people along, but in a digital sense, not in a conventional physical sense. The other part is that we could imagine taking the DNA of humanity along with us, so the physical form, not just the digital form, but the physical form. So we're actually looking at that for the biological program of sending biological samples that would wake up once they got to the arrival point. This is all part of sort of a long-term sort of futuristic plan. We'd love people to think about it and kind of let your imagination not go wild in a crazy way, but go wild in terms of thinking about possibility. What could really be done here? As much as I love the movies, and I do like going to watch science fiction movies, as do many scientists, by the way. But when we want to do science, it's a little bit different. We have to actually then focus on what's really possible at this point. And while the future will hold many surprises for us, and hopefully we will find ways to go, much faster, and perhaps we'll figure out a way to see the speed of light or find some other way to get over vast distances quickly. Currently, we're kind of stuck with the physics we have. And the last part of this is that due to relativistic effect, if you put biology on board, the clock rate on board the spacecraft is ticking at a different clock rate than is your biology. This is like the so-called twin paradox. We shoot out biology at extremely high speed. It arrives at the destination much sooner than your clock would say it arrived. And therefore, there's another way to ponder this whole way of exploring the universe. Is that when I turn on a flashlight and point it out in the universe, you might ask yourself, how long does it take the light to get to the nearest star? And, something Alpha Centauri is about 40 light years away, it must take it 4 years. But that's 4 years on our clock. On the clock on board the photon, there is no clock, by the way, it takes zero time, literally zero. Not like a little, but zero. So it actually gets across the entire universe instantaneously in its clock. And this is just this is just how physics is. Time proceeds at a different rate depending on how fast you're going. And the faster you go, the slower it proceeds until you get to the speed of light, in which case it stops. So time completely stops on light. So there is no clock on light. Light doesn't have four dimensions. It really only has two dimensions. And you think it has three spatial, no time, okay, but actually it has only two spatial because you collapse the longitudinal dimension. But, anyway, this is another, beautiful and kind of mind-blowing part of reality, is that what we perceive as reality is very nice, but it's not all there is, and that as we go faster and faster relative to things, we see a different kind of universe altogether.
So this is an interesting question from Alex in your old neighborhood of Berkeley. And he says, it's been a while since I've seen Star Trek on television, but I seem to recall that the way they did time travel into the past was to accelerate very, very rapidly with warp drive and then do something different to sling them into the past, and you could see their chronometers going in reverse. So as you go out with more and more beamed propulsion and more speed, is there something you could do to go into the past?
Okay. So this whole idea of time travel, it is great in the movies, and there is some mathematical basis to possibly, I say very hypothetically, possibly being able to travel back in time through certain general relativistic effects, primarily around compact objects, black holes. But I would say very few people are convinced that, A, it's even possible physically, mathematically, there's certain solutions which seem to, like they might allow it. And then let alone, be able to physically realize something like that. So, yeah, of course, it's, When you look at the details of Star Trek or Star Wars or any of these things, and they travel vast distances and they come back to where they started from, and the people are still around, that violates what we know about current physics. Now, it might be possible to do that in some sort of wormhole event that we haven't quite figured out, even mathematically, if it's possible, or whether it's consistent with general relativity or not, but we don't know how to fill in the missing pieces. So if you watch those portions of Star Trek carefully, there's always something that's just hidden from you. How do they really do it? We don't know. They don't know either.
Of course, they don't know either. But
they don't know either. Yeah, but it makes for great science fiction, and that's the beauty of the human mind. You can imagine things that don't necessarily have to exist, but you can imagine all kinds of things. If the question, which I think part of the question was, as you go faster, do you then go backwards in time? No, our current understanding is that as you go faster, as you approach the speed of light, your time slows down and eventually stops as you get to the speed of light. Now, you might ask what happens as you go faster than the speed of light. And there, we enter a world which is sometimes called the world of tachyons, where you are going faster than the speed of light. Then it becomes quite interesting. There are all kinds of imaginary solutions. I mean, not just imaginary as you imagine, but actually in terms of complex mathematics. I mean, not that I realize I'm starting mixing up things for people, but you can have imaginary numbers in mathematics. You can actually get imaginary masses and all kinds of interesting effects as you exceed the speed of light. But we've never done that. We don't know. It's all just extending analytic. In calculations, and no one knows if that has any relation to reality or not. It's definitely something fun to think about. At the moment, we don't have a way to even test it, let alone realize it.
Sarah's in Salt Lake City, and I know you've been very generous with our time, so this will probably be our last question for the day. But Sarah's in Salt Lake, and she says, I'm a true space cadet, and I love the space industry, and I have a son who is in high school, and he really loves this stuff, too. I'll have him listen to this program on archive. What would be the academic path for a high school student of today to be able to go into the world of physics that you're talking about to work on and contribute and to possibly even one day be a PI in a project for interstellar flight? What type of physics is it, or is there a different path?
Well, that's a, I think, a very practical and a really good question as to those people that are interested in this as a career path, not interstellar travel as a career path, but just the, you know, kind of the exploration of space and the exploration of science in general. You know, what things can you do yourself or to help children who might be interested in this? And I think it's a great question. I spend a lot of my life interacting with students and have for decades. It's one of the more satisfying things that you can do in life is you can actually, I think, help sort of expand someone's horizon so they see that sense of wonder in the world around them. And it really is quite a beautiful world when you look at it very mathematically. I think the very best thing you could do is encourage your son to study as much mathematics and study as much science or biology, whether it's geology or physics or chemistry, whatever it is. I mean, you should be open to all kinds of things in the mathematical realm. And one of the best things, though, if you want something very specific, is just study as much math as you can, because you'll never be disappointed in general that you study too much mathematics. You can apply it so beautifully to the physical world of many things, whether you're building cars or building, you know, interstellar spacecraft. The mathematics becomes absolutely key. I think what the best thing to do to stimulate the minds of children in particular is to allow them to see the absolute beauty of the physical world around them. You know, allow them to take a magnifying glass out and explore a leaf or, you know, look at bugs or, you know, whatever it is that, as a child that stimulates you. You don't have to study calculus when you're in kindergarten to appreciate the beauty of the world. You can just see it for what it is. And that's what I would definitely recommend. You know, if you're interested, you can, you know, look me up, you know, contact me, or, you know, look at our work on the website and on the archives. Just Google us. You'll find all kinds of our papers and articles and, you know, things have been written about what we're doing. This is very much for me a human endeavor. It's not an ego question. It's not a personal issue. Like I said, I honestly, this is an honest assessment. I don't think I'm going to be around on this earth when this stuff finally comes to fruition. But I'm, at this point, I don't see any reason why we can't do this. It looks viable. There's a lot of hard engineering challenges and a lot of interesting technology that we want to develop better than what we have today. But actually, we have the rudiments of what we need. Much as if you go back to the year, say, 1937, which was 80 years ago, and look at the state of space travel in 1937, and of course you say, well, we hadn't traveled to space, and that was correct. But if you look at what people were talking about in the year 1937, just prior to the onset of World War II in 1939, you look at what were people already talking about that had been working in rocketry, both in Europe, in Russia, the Soviet Union at that point, and in the United States, as well as many other places. People already knew that based on the physical systems that they had developed at that point, and based on the mathematics, that there was no reason they couldn't take what they had at that point, scale it up, and go to the moon. People already knew it was possible. They knew that it was possible to go into orbit. They knew it was possible to go further than orbit. They didn't have all the details in front of them, and they lacked, you know, certainly the modern electronics that are really critical, but they already have the propulsion systems. You know, if you look at what's currently being done in companies such as SpaceX, Amazon, other places where there are, you know, private space programs that are very ambitious, very sophisticated. Look at the rocket design. They're primarily liquid oxygen and hydrocarbon fuels such as kerosene, that I think they call RP-1, Rocket Propellant 1, which is basically just a fancy name for, you know, a type of kerosene. It's the same thing with the V-2. you know, which is liquid oxygen and kerosene. And the V2 is, you know, basically 1943, I guess it was. But, you know, people were already messing around. They were, you know, exploring rocket engines that were already using a cryogenic propellant, which is liquid oxygen combined with either hydrocarbon. They were using kerosene, gasoline. You know, people have been exploring liquid hydrogen. And they knew. They knew that there was nothing really new that had to be developed. There was a lot of hard engineering to take the existing technology, scale it up. But they already worked out on paper that you could go into orbit and go to the moon if you were, you know, really wanted to push it. And from 1937 to the moon landing in 1969, you know, it was 32 years. And I think we're kind of in a similar place here. If we push hard for the next 32 years, that'll put us into the year, 1948, I guess, would be. Sorry, 2048. Sorry, push us to 2048. That we could be at a place where we would be ready to launch. And, you know, if we push harder, we can probably go faster because we really have the mathematics well behind us. We have the physics behind us. And we have the technology. I wouldn't say it's completely done yet, but we're kind of ready to go in terms of building up the highly integrated infrastructure that we need.
Well, I would
and
be
so
a,
I,
go, I'm sorry, yeah. Go ahead.
No, this is not, you know, we're in a place where we really want to be looking forward to what do we need to do to really accomplish this, as well as looking at what are all the stumbling blocks. Definitely we should look at that, but what do we need to do to accomplish this? And, you know, there is a roadmap, and we can get to that roadmap if we work on it together. And this is very much, I would love to see this as an international program, you know, rather than just a national program at all, but I realize politics comes into this and will continue to for the foreseeable future.
Well, in 2048, I'll be 102, so I hope it happens a lot faster.
We'll just have to work harder.
I have one more question, if you can stay, and I'll give it
sure,
to
go
you.
Ahead.
Ken is in Memphis, and he said, since financing is always a problem and may be a problem for decades to come, given the way we use our public money, are there possible commercial models or spinoffs that could help make money and finance projects and development along the way, especially if commercial companies got involved?
The answer is yes. And I've given a couple of talks at various companies whose business is space launch. And, you know, I always preface my talks with these kind of companies saying that I'm not here to convince you there's a business case for interstellar flight because I don't see it. And I honestly don't see it. There's a case for human exploration of the stars, but it's much like we didn't see the case for, you know, space exploration in the 1960s for private companies. We thought it was the domain of countries, not companies. I think the same is true here. I don't see the case at all for the long foreseeable future of interstellar flight being interesting to companies. However, the technological spin-offs of what we're doing, I see as being of immediate interest to companies for reasons that have to do not with interstellar travel, but having to do with near-Earth and interplanetary travel. The same kind of system can be used in a variety of modes, and those modes are relevant to immediate needs and desires that people have for enabling cheaper access to space, rapid access to space, less hazardous access to space. There's absolutely a number of very positive things industry where the money made from those endeavors could finance the long-term development for interstellar flight. And you're right, I don't expect, even though if you look at the FY17 NASA budget it's put together by the Appropriations Committee, you'll see our work mentioned, unknown to us. We had nothing to do with it being mentioned except we did the work. But it was actually mentioned in the FY17 appropriations bill as this is something that the Appropriations Committee for NASA thought that NASA should be exploring, which would be, in their mind, a 100th year anniversary of the moon landing, i.e. 2069, as being the appropriate date for an interstellar mission. I thought, you know, that's a very clever thing for them to say, and it's about the right time scale. It may even be a little bit slower than we were thinking of, but I think it's not unreasonable to ponder that. But people already, you know, people are coming on board in the sense that they see this might be an interesting way to go, even though I don't see the money being available to do it at the moment. We're always money constrained. Yeah, it's true. But at the moment, we're actually working on problems that we don't need $1 trillion to solve. You know, yes, you will need a huge amount of money to build the system in the end, although the prices are dropping exponentially, as you'll see in our paper, as well as increasing exponentially in capability. But importantly, the prices are dropping exponentially. That's a good thing. So it may be cheaper than I think in the long run. And judging by the cost that you would have been told would take to build an iPhone or a phone, smartphone, 50 years ago, it would have been an unbelievable amount of money. In fact, a gigabyte of memory in the year 1955 was, I think, of order $1 trillion. 1955, of course, today it's a dollar. You know, these exponential growth technologies have a way of being vastly cheaper than you imagine they're going to be on this train of decreasing cost. And this is very much a photonics-driven program. It's not pouring concrete. You know, we're not using technologies that are, you know, steel or, you know, concrete or things like that, which don't decrease in price exponentially. We're using things which do decrease in price exponentially. So it may be vastly cheaper than we imagine, but still not going to be, you know, that cheap. But yes, to answer your question, absolutely. There are immediate spinoffs that would interest a lot of people and be useful for very practical things right now.
I got one more question. Can you take it?
Yeah, go ahead.
Sam is in Los Angeles, and he says, David devotes a lot of space shuttle programming to Alcubierre warp drive, M-drive, Mach thrusters, and exotic propulsion of that nature. Where does that fit in, or is that less ready than even what you're talking about?
The very best technology is the imaginary technology. It works perfectly.
Every time, right?
Every time, yeah. I love warp drives, and I love wormholes, and I love kind of imaginary technologies. I just don't know how to realize them in the real world. I can see them in my mind. You know, I just push a button and boom, I'm there. So of all the things you mentioned, you know, there is something called the EM drive, which if you Google it, you'll see is a very mysterious and interesting thing. Most of my colleagues are, skeptical is a word. I'll just leave it at that. And so we're waiting to see, you know, the data from that system being reproduced and looking at the systematic errors and stuff. It's a, you know, I'd urge people to, all scientists should be skeptical of everything. You should be skeptical about everything I'm saying, and you should be skeptical of everything any other scientist says, whether it has to do with any aspect of science. If you're not a skeptic, you're not a scientist. Scientists don't believe, they question. So you should question everything. So you know, you should look at all the interesting hypothetical and proposed systems for you know, getting somewhere fast, and then ask yourself, you know, show me the data, and, you know, show me the mathematics behind it. It doesn't mean that there aren't things we haven't discovered. I'm quite certain there are things we haven't discovered yet. I think that's just a complete non-brainer that we don't understand everything, so there must be things that we haven't discovered yet. That I think we know with a certainty. Whether 100 years from now we will look back and say, that was a really stupid idea to use lasers to go to the stars. You know, we have this new, push the button and you enter, you know, some hologram, and then boom, there you are. I don't know what it is, but I'm trying to work with the real world that I know at the moment to enable a real path forward today. I would love 30 years from now, you know, we get down to the point where it's ready to go, and all we need is is, you know, to push the button to launch, and someone says, wait a minute, I have the, you know, the magic thing. You just look in here, you can get to the, you know, just open this door and you're at the next planet or the next star. That'd be fantastic. I don't know how to do it. So please be skeptical. First thing you learn as a scientist.
China issued a press release 2 weeks ago that they had tested an M drive in space and it worked and have provided no additional details. I knew you'd get a kick out, but that is a real Chinese news agency press release. We covered
yeah.
it on the space show with a big smile. But
I love it. I love these kinds of technologies. I'm amazed it was an official Chinese press release, but I don't know what that means.
I can send it to you if you'd like to see it.
Sure, yeah, I would love to see that. Of course, I think all of my colleagues would love to see something which violates our current sensibilities in science, because that would then show us a new way forward. I would love that. I would love someone to show me something which is currently inconsistent with what we know about science and math and the mathematics of physics. That's, I don't have any problem with that, but we need the data. We need the proof that these things work rather than they're due to some subtle systematic error. And, I'm all ears, you know. Find something, I would love to see it.
Any specific concluding comments or takeaways you'd like to leave us with for today other than to be skeptical and question?
No, I think this has been very useful to talk about some of the key challenges. A lot of the questions were right on target in terms of, you know, what is what's required here besides money? You know, what's the where the technological readiness level, the TRL, that was question number one, but in a broader sense. And, you know, look forward to an amazing future. You know, look at not just our work, but look at all kinds of other work and proposed ideas. You know, look up fusion engines and look up EM drives and, you know, try to draw your own conclusions and don't take someone's word for anything. You know, be your own skeptic, be your own scientist, and, you know, just go forth from there. Hopefully we'll find a way together to get to the stars in our lifetime.
Doctor, thank you very much for being our guest today and for staying extra time. We really appreciate your being with us.
No problem. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you. Listeners, that's it for today. And we do thank Dr. Lubin. And check the newsletters for programs tomorrow and the rest of the week. Goodbye, everybody, from the Space Show.